Hello, and welcome to this online event at the International Inequalities Institute at the London School of Economics. My name is Neil Lee. I'm Professor of Economic Geography at the LSE. I also run the Cities, Jobs and Economics Change research theme here in the International Inequalities Institute. Now, today's subject is a topical one. So the UK has a number of elections today. A lot of attention, you know, we have big elections in Scotland and of course in Wales, but a lot of attention has gone to two of these votes in particular: a rich cosmopolitan city of London, which is expected to vote Labour, and a poorer town, Hartlepool, which is less affluent and is expected to vote for the right, the reverse of what we'd sort of traditionally see. So if the pollsters are correct, these are sort of big shifts in our politics as we divide between affluent liberal cities and right-wing voters in formerly industrial areas, a sort of pattern which you can see replicated in everything from sort of Brexit to the Gilets Jaunes. So the question which we'll be asking in our event today is, are regional inequalities driving us apart? Are geographical divides driving political polarization? Now, one of the great things about my job is that I get to choose people who I think are doing really interesting work in this area to debate these issues. And I'm really pleased to welcome our panel today, who are four, I think, superb speakers. So first up, we have Maria Abreu. Maria is a regional economist at the Department for Land Economy in Pembroke College at the University of Cambridge. Now, I didn't know this until I was looking into her CV earlier, but she's also LSE alumni. And, you know, it happens to be a coincidence that everyone good we get on these has some association with the LSE, but Maria fits into that category. But she's also done some superb work looking at the geography of populism. So we're very pleased to have her speaking. Next up, we will have Jonathan Hopkin, Professor of Comparative Politics in the Department of Government at the LSE. And I would highly recommend his book, Anti-System Politics. Here's a sort of shameless plug, because I know he's too modest to do it himself. Extremely, you know, well worth reading. You know, great book, starts, it's sort of eye-opening book in lots of ways. And we're really pleased that he's going to be talking about some of the themes in it today. I'd recommend that book. I'd also recommend this book by Ellen Helsper, who's Professor of Digital Inequalities at the LSE and co-convener of the Politics of Inequality research theme at the International Inequalities Institute. Her book, The Digital Disconnect, you know, I'd highly recommend it. It's a very good read. We're looking forward to hearing more about what's in it today. And finally, last but not least, we have Andres Rodriguez-Pose. Now, he's the Princesa de Asturias Chair and Professor of Economic Geography at the LSE. He's Director of the Canada Blanche Centre here at the LSE. And one of the main reasons we have him here, because he's a sort of, you know, has a wonderful international perspective on these things, but also his paper, Revenge of the Places That Don't Matter, has been one of the most important pieces in our understanding of the geography of populism. So what's going to happen now is the four speakers are each going to give a sort of 10-minute presentation on their opinions on the sort of topic. Then after that, there's going to be plenty of time for debate and questions from all of you. We should be finishing about 8 o'clock British time. Just to say, the online event is being recorded and will be made available as a video and a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties, my script tells me optimistically. So there's going to be plenty of opportunities for you to put your questions to the panel. To submit your questions, please use the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen, stating your name and affiliation. Questions will go to myself and I will take the most difficult ones and give them to our panelists. I will pose as many as possible to our speakers. Let us know your name and affiliation. We're particularly keen to hear from many of our students, alumni, incoming students, so please do let us know. Before I hand over to Maria, I have to give a sort of final plug to a couple of events we have lined up here at the III. Next week, we have the event Refusing Discriminatory Technologies of Power, Racial Justice and the Challenge of High-Tech Policing, which is held as part of the Inequalities Seminar Series on Tuesday, the 11th of May from 12:30 to 1:30 BST. Then on Wednesday, we have, at the same time, we have the heirs, managers and the bureaucrats sketching economic power in contemporary France as part of a new seminar series, which we're launching, on building collaborations in the sociological analysis of European elites. Now, Nina, who's sort of the maestro of this event, she's posting details of both of these events in the chat. So now, thank you very much for joining. I'm going to hand over to Maria, the first speaker.
Great, thanks very much, and really pleased to be back at the LSE virtually. Okay, so I'm going to share my screen. Okay, so I thought I'd start with the the standard economic perspective on what's happening, and then I'm going to add a few caveats and then discuss a few policy implications or views. So I guess the standard story within the economics literature is that recent economic shocks, particularly globalization, but also technical change, AI and algorithms and so on, have shifted the have led to the loss of jobs across the entire geography in high income countries and led to the creation of new jobs, but these new jobs are highly concentrated, particularly concentrated in highly diverse and skilled and innovative cities. So the new jobs are concentrated, the loss has been fairly widespread, and as a result we have places that have been where there's a feeling that they've been left behind, and there are very few prospects of anything changing. And then there are other forces that have exacerbated these effects or shifts. So we have out-migration from these declining places, particularly of the young and the skilled and healthy, leading to additional policy problems. Neglect by policymakers, who tend to focus on the successful cities, and then linked to that, low levels of funding, infrastructure funding, but also education funding and health funding, particularly given the problems that have been caused by out-migration and demographic change. And then finally, a feeling that there are no prospects of recovery. And then on the political side, this leads to political disengagement in these left behind communities, high levels of distrust towards local and national politicians, who local residents feel that haven't done anything to improve the situation. And then this leads to low turnout in elections, and or when a policy choice comes along that tells a different story, perhaps an increase in support for populist parties. So I think that story, the standard economic story, is very nicely summarized in this diagram, which I've sort of adapted slightly from a paper by Danny Roderick on globalization and populism that came out last year, which is a critical survey of the literature within economics. So in this diagram, we have economic shocks. In the paper, Danny Roderick focuses on globalization, but I think we can include the financial crisis and the austerity program that followed in many countries, leading to economic grievances in among the left behind communities. And then these in turn lead to residents having policy preferences for populist political programs, and therefore an increase in the populist vote. This is on the demand side. However, the economic grievances might also lead political parties to change the way they present their policy options and perhaps move towards populism. So on the supply side, we also have political parties changing what they're offering, and therefore an increase in the populist vote, simply because there's more populism available to vote for. Then within this sort of literature, there's also a view that changing political party programs might lead to a change in cultural attitudes, as political parties perhaps encourage cultural divisions in order to increase their vote. So this would be the culture war story. In the standard view, culture is a consequence of the economic. Cultural grievances are a consequence of economic grievances. So the arrow points in one direction here. And I'm going to talk about this in a minute. So the idea is that economic grievances lead to cultural divides. So these are my sort of additions or changes. I think this story that economic grievances lead to cultural grievances is too simple. Particularly if we assume that they it happens in contemporaneously in the same period. So it could be that long-run economic grievances eventually change cultural and social attitudes, but I would argue that this is a long-run process and not a one-way street. And the second thing is that in terms of the shocks are not just economic, but also demographic and institutional. So this would be the cultural backlash story by Inglehart and Norris. So there's demographic change, and that leads to cultural change, which in turn leads to to changing policy preferences and populist votes. And within institutional change, I would include things like devolution, or which could be an exogenous shock that affects cultural and identity, cultural attitudes and identity. So for the remainder of my talk, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the economic versus the cultural, and how this matters at the local level. Okay, I want to show you two pictures. So these were adverts that were used by the Leave campaigns during the Brexit referendum. So these were shown on Facebook. They were created by Aggregate IQ, so Cambridge Analytica sister company, and they were released by Facebook to a parliamentary committee that was investigating the campaign. And they're really worth looking through, because so the messaging is quite interesting, and I've picked two out that I think have a local context. And what I'm trying to show is that even during the campaign understood the importance of the local context in driving out the vote. So we have this first one, which is, so this is about flooding in Yorkshire. So presumably these were shown to social media viewers in users in Yorkshire. And it says, do you want to send £350 million a week to the EU or flood defences for Yorkshire? And then you get to decide, and you click on one of these. If you click on Yorkshire, you get more targeted advertising. And then the second one, which is about the steel industry, I think it doesn't have a localized message, but it clearly is clearly directed at certain specific places, probably Yorkshire and Wales. So I think this illustrates the fact that the local context was important in the campaign on the supply side, and therefore that local context probably matters for the sort of the political outcomes that we're observing. So for the final bit of my talk, I want to show you some of my own results with my colleagues. We have been trying to disentangle two issues that are driving the spatial dimension of the populist votes. The issue is that if you have, so I'm going to illustrate it with two highly abstract examples. So I've got two towns here, town A and town B. And there are two types of residents in these towns, so the blue ones and the grey ones. And assuming that these residents have some sort of different characteristics that make them vote in a different way, regardless of where they live. If we're looking at these two towns and say we assume the blue figures are younger voters, so we can see at a glance that town B is younger, and we'd expect town B therefore to vote in a way that reflects perhaps more liberal social attitudes, or perhaps less likely to vote for Brexit, purely on the basis of the composition of the people who live in them. But the problem is that then this obscures, if these towns are identical in terms of economic and cultural context, then that's fine. But if they differ in their economic and cultural context, then it's really difficult to tell whether what's driving the local vote is the composition or the context. And so the way we've tried to get around this is by using a matching method. So we match individuals across places that are different. On a long list of characteristics, including age and gender and education, income, home ownership, personality, even the newspaper they read. And then we compare samples of very similar individuals living in different places to see whether it's the context that matters. So in this example, I'm matching some very similar people, and then we trim the remainder of the sample, and we end up with two samples that are very similar. So this is what we use in the kind of these results I'm going to show you now. We did this for the Brexit vote, and we found in a paper that came out last year that composition explains a third of the vote, and the other two thirds are due to context. This is at the parliamentary constituency level. And then we looked at both cultural and economic context, and we were expecting to see that economic context had the biggest effect, but actually we found that it was all pretty much all cultural contexts that mattered. So cultural context we found was really important when comparing two very groups of very similar people, and in particular it was views on immigration and also more weakly our views on female emancipation and climate change and those kinds of views. So following fitting in with the cultural backlash theory. And in terms of economic context, we found that education was the only variable that had a very strong explanatory power. But of course, education is both a cultural and an economic variable. So places that were highly, on average, highly educated were more likely to vote remain regardless of their composition. Or alternatively, a person with low levels of education working in a manual occupation but living in a highly educated area was more likely to vote remain than a very similar person living in an area that had a lower average educational level. There's also a very marginal, very small effect, contextual effect for low wage growth. So we concluded in this paper that context explains a very large portion of the vote, but it's cultural context that matters. And then in this second paper I want to talk about, this is with Calvin Jones at Cardiff Business School. And we were trying to find not a natural experiment, but a way of disentangling the different kinds of explanations for why cultural context matters. And what we try to do here is look at former coal mining communities in the UK and matching both individuals and towns to other communities that were similarly deprived and similarly urban or rural, but that didn't have the history of economic decline. And so we were trying to understand whether it was the economic history that was explaining the cultural dimension. And so we did the same kind of matching process. And here, this diagram is showing views of voters in or residents in coal mining communities on various aspects of the democratic process. And we're comparing them to very similar people living in similarly deprived communities that were not former coal mining communities. And the dashed line is the zero point. So anything to the left of that line shows that residents in coal mining communities had a more negative view of the statement. And these bars are 95% confidence intervals. And these variables are all standardized so we can compare them to each other. So what we find is very low levels of political efficacy and engagement in the political process. So we find voters in coal mining communities are significantly less likely to say democracy works well in this country, less likely to say that voting is a civic duty, that voting is a social norm, or that there are personal benefits from voting. Interestingly, no difference to other deprived communities in terms of group the benefits to their group from voting. They're less likely to say they're qualified to participate in politics, and that they're less likely to say they're well informed. Marginally, not statistically significant, but they're more likely to say that public officials don't care about people like them, that they themselves have little say in what the government does, so a sort of lack of agency.
Maria, just 1 minute.
Yep, that's fine. They're less likely to say they have an interest in politics. Very little difference in which kind of party they support compared to other deprived communities, except very marginally that they're more likely to vote to leave the EU. And then very significant lower level of voting intention at the next election, although you can see there's a very big variation reflecting personal and local characteristics. The last figure I want to show you, this is looking at the interest in politics in coal mining communities over time. The coal mining areas are the bottom line. This is using matched samples, so even matching to very similar people in similar communities, similarly deprived communities, we see that they have a lower interest in politics. And then we see that in all of these deprived communities, there is an increase in interest around the time of the Brexit referendum. But then this levels off in the coal mining communities after the Brexit vote. So to conclude with some policy implications, We argue, or I argue, that people living in areas in long-term decline are highly politically disengaged, and this is the primary feature of the political process in these places. And this is also linked to low levels of political efficacy and perception that politicians are out of touch. And this includes both local politicians and national politicians. And I expect also EU politicians at the time of the referendum. And the interesting thing, or what we try to show in these papers, is that this is the case, even if these residents, these voters, are not personally affected by government policies. So these might be wealthy people living in declining communities who vote in a certain way, and that is different to had they lived in another community that was less deprived or in decline, regardless of their own personal situation. And then my solution or my conclusion is that in terms of policy, I think this means that economic policies that simply try to improve productivity or fix infrastructure are not likely to change the feelings of disengagement. And what we need is to increase agency. So to give local communities, to involve them in decisions about what the local area needs and in local development policies. And then I would also argue, in terms of the levelling up agenda, that policies designed by the central government for local areas, I think, are not likely to change these perceptions. And I'll stop there.
Wonderful, thank you. Fascinating stuff. So disengagement, not radicalization, and need for local control. That's great. We'll just, if it is okay, I'll just head straight on to Jonathan.
For his sure.
Thank you.
Excellent, right. Hope you can all see the screen. So first of all, Neil's very kindly given a plug to the book, and here is the cover. And I've kind of varied the title for the purposes of this evening's discussion. And I don't actually want to argue that regional inequalities are unimportant or that local contexts are unimportant in explaining variations in what I call in the book anti-system politics, but I guess many of you will think about as populism. What I try and do in the book is, well, first of all, it's a comparative piece of work, and I look at a bunch of advanced democracies which have undergone kind of political shocks over the last decade. So I look at the UK, obviously Brexit being the main, but not the only form of anti-system politics in the UK. I look at the US with Trump and Sanders. I also look at Italy and Spain. I also have a chapter on the Eurozone crisis. And the question I'm asking really is, why is it that in this last decade or so, we've had so many of these kind of political shocks? And why have these political shocks taken different forms in different places? So by place here, I'm referring to cross-country differences, but many of the same arguments could also be applied to territorial differences within countries. But what I focus on is this this cross-country set of differences. So what I'm also trying to do in the book, in a way, is to question or challenge a little bit this notion, which has been very popular in the UK with the Brexit vote being very strong in the north of England, for example, where I'm from, even though I now live in the north of London, a very different kind of context. But also in the US, the left behind communities, the Rust Belt and so on. This idea that really what's going on here is a bunch of people, working class people, white working class people, very often it is emphasized, who are rebelling against being ignored. But, you know, we've seen plenty of examples of actually very different kinds of people, people who don't live in left behind places, people who are not necessarily working class, may indeed be university students or highly educated professionals, who are also complaining about things. They're complaining about racism, they're complaining about the police and their attitude to particular groups in society, they're complaining about rents and so on. And so this produces very different kinds of politics, which may have a common source, and I agree completely with Maria in identifying this causal path between economic shocks and political outcomes. But we need to think about why you get different kinds of political outcomes. And, you know, there is a lot of pages to read in my book, which I encourage you to buy to get the full story. Boiled down very, very simply, what I'm trying to argue is this, which is that there are right-wing and left-wing responses to the set of crises we're facing. And these right and left-wing appeals appeal to different kinds of voters. In fairly obvious ways, I draw a lot on the work of Pippa Norris and Ronald Inglehart, who wrote a book, Cultural Backlash, which doesn't solely place the emphasis on cultural dimensions of political contestation, but they do identify and present plenty of data to suggest that very socially conservative attitudes of the kind associated with the Brexit vote or with Trump or with right-wing populism in Europe is more likely to be popular amongst often older, often less educated in particular voters, whereas the sort of social liberal appeal of more left-wing kinds of anti-system parties are more popular amongst younger voters, amongst more educated voters. So this gives us a kind of a clue for understanding how it is that anti-system politics plays out in different places. And what I try and do is I add to that by looking at the ways in which different countries are affected differently by shocks such as the financial crisis of the first decade of the century, but also different people within these societies are affected in different ways, depending on the institutions and in particular the kind of welfare state institutions that different countries have. So what I'm arguing is that some countries are affected more by crises than others, and I'll give a pointer to that in a moment why, but also within countries, different kinds of different people are protected to different extents and in different ways against these shocks. And so, you know, very, very simply, rudimentary typology here, which some of you know, comparative social policy literatures and Esping Anderson's Three Worlds of Welfare Capitalism will be very familiar with. You have this kind of Anglo-Saxon liberal type of welfare state that doesn't protect people very much. So all very wide range of different kinds of voters can be at risk and suffering economic hardship. Northern European welfare states instead are much more generous, much more comprehensive, although some groups have lost out due to welfare reforms in the recent past. And then you have Southern European kind of welfare states, which have a very dualistic form of social protection. So you have these older insider citizens who tend to be very well protected, pensioners, people in stable jobs, and younger outsider citizens much more exposed. Also, if we think about it in terms of the position of different countries in global economic imbalances, global financial imbalances in particular, we also see this pattern whereby the creditor countries tend to predominantly vote more for right-wing anti-system parties and debtor countries more for left-wing anti-system parties. And in Anglo-Saxon countries, you tend to get a bit of both. So just, you know, I won't, there's not too much of this kind of quantitative data in the book, but just one quite interesting chart here is that simply shows how the extent of the current account deficits or the trade deficit, which a country had just before the financial crisis, is a very good predictor of its income growth in the immediate aftermath of the crisis. And what you see there, you know, in the bottom left-hand corner, Greece, with a massive current account deficit in 2008, got totally hammered. Very strong negative income growth in the years after the financial crisis. At the other end of the scale, Norway, which had a thumping surplus, was much less affected by the crisis, and people were forced to tighten their belts to a much more limited extent. And, you know, I pick out my countries here, the Great Britain here, obviously, Italy, Spain, Greece. These are countries which have all had a bad crisis. They had a bad crisis in the first half of the last decade. In many respects, this crisis is still being felt. And this has determined there being a strong pressure to rebel against the mainstream political parties that are seen as being responsible for how bad the crisis was. But if we pick out these countries in terms of their creditor or debtor status before the crisis and then look inside the ways in which they organize their welfare provision, we can come up with kind of a basic mapping of what, how much anti-system politics there's going to be and what kind there's going to be. So I'm going to skip over this fairly quickly because we don't have that much time. But if we look at the second column to the left, the creditor countries, countries which were on balance consuming less than they produced, and effectively lending money to the rest of the world before the financial crisis, countries like Germany, Sweden, Netherlands, France almost, were far less affected by the crisis. And what's tended to happen is you haven't seen an anti-system takeover, although there's quite often been a growth of right-wing populism in these countries. So the AfD in Germany, the Front National in France, PVV and other parties in the Netherlands, suggest that there is an anti-system backlash there. It tends to be on the right. And the reason it tends to be on the right is because the kind of voters that are most likely to have felt the effects of austerity measures that were taken, even in those countries, despite the crisis being less severe, are more likely to have felt hardship. If we move over to the other two columns on the right, debtor countries come in two different varieties. We have this kind of dualistic welfare state in Southern Europe, which protects some people very well, especially older people, and leaves younger outsider voters out in the cold. And what this has tended to produce, although with some exceptions, is a strong showing for left anti-system political parties in Spain, Greece, and Italy. I'm sure some of you might have noticed that the anti-system left didn't do as well as it hoped in the Madrid mayoral elections yesterday. But on the whole, as I'll show you in a minute, there's some data suggests that on the whole, this pattern holds up. If we look at the final column on the right, these more residual Anglo-Saxon type welfare states basically tend to leave very large parts of the population, both insider and outsiders, at risk of economic losses. And the result of that is you get strong anti-system pressures from both sides. So in the UK, you have Brexit, which has been mostly on the right, but also you have Corbynism, which is very much on the left and obviously dominated Labour politics for 5 years. And of course, the Scottish Nationalists were not really a left-wing party as such, but certainly not right-wing populist. And in the US, alongside Trump, we also have Sanders, and to much to my surprise, and maybe many of us, ultimately the strong growth of this kind of left-wing anti-system politics advocated by Bernie Sanders has led to Joe Biden, ostensibly a centrist moderate, following some of the most radical economic policies seen in the United States for probably since the 1960s. Okay, so, you know, another selling point of the book.
Got about a minute and a bit left. So
I can do it. I can do it. I've done it before. I'll do it again. So my publisher was very keen that I should have a chart with a quirky name. So here it is. When I was playing around with this data, I found that on average in the creditor countries, and in my data set here, this is generally kind of continental and Northern European countries, countries with trade surpluses, Germany being the most obvious one, and looking at debtor countries and dividing the support for anti-system parties into left-wing and right-wing types, it came out that actually you have this, I think it looks like a crocodile, you might not agree, but what you can see is that the real trend has been that left-wing anti-system parties have done better in the debtor countries and right-wing in anti-system parties better in the creditor countries. And this has driven really my analysis of what I think the reasons for these different kind of reactions are. So Neil will be pleased to know I'm onto the conclusions page. So yeah, just to summarize, types of welfare state and the kind of labor market institutions, which I explain in much more detail, of course, in the book, determined which groups are most exposed to the crisis and therefore which kind of anti-system reactions tend to predominate, because different demographic types of voters have different sort of prior preferences and more likely to prefer either left-wing or right-wing politics if they want to protest. Within countries, place, territory is correlated with a lot of variables that matter. So, you know, Maria's produced some fascinating research, which I hadn't read, and I'm going to have to follow up on, and Andres will talk about this later, and I'm sure that context matters. But there are also a lot of other sort of patterns of conflict, lines, dimensions of conflict, which count and which help shape what kinds of populist or anti-system reactions you get. And, you know, my closing point is, as somebody who's moved from East Yorkshire to North London, and passing through a lot of other places on the way, places, of course, not, sorry, I meant exogenous rather than endogenous, mistake there, people can kind of choose where they want to live. And sometimes people like me gravitate to places other than the kind of places they were born in. And that is obviously going to drive to some extent how place plays out in politics. Thanks for listening.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Jonathan. I'm taken with your crocodile graph. And I will, I will rip that off because the idea of having a quirky graph is quite good. Ellen, we'll go to you next. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Let me share what I have to say. So yeah, thank you first of all for plugging the book. I will also have some images of the book on my slides here. So I'm going to talk about a slightly different aspect of inequalities, regional inequalities, in relation to the research that I've been doing over the past few decades almost around digital inequalities and how they relate to inequalities in participation in society and everyday life and full citizenship and who gets to participate fully and reap the benefits of the digitization and how that might be unequally distributed. So as I say in the title of the book, it's really looking at what are the causes of people not being able to engage or similarly or being disconnected from a world that's increasingly digital, but also what are the consequences of this. And in the book, I discuss this around a number of areas. And two of these that I will be focusing on in this presentation is one is civic participation or empowerment. And the other is about the creation of content online. And I'll show in this presentation how they are related to a certain extent. So we'll talk about regional, but also about spatial digital inequalities and polarization, or as I will come to at the end of the presentation, more talk about segregation and homogenization of public debate and discourse that might exclude certain people who therefore might kind of resist an elitist or a kind of discourse that comes from a more powerful, historically powerful groups and individuals. And I'll talk about three aspects of it, or actually two aspects and then solutions. One is about the kind of inequalities that exist in the ability to participate politically and civically in digital spaces and how that is unequally distributed regionally, globally, but also within countries and then within cities, which is the research that I do is focused on. And then I'll, in a second part, I'll actually look at the online space and how there's a certain segregation taking place of these kind of online spaces where political and civic participation and the creation of discourse takes place. And I'll finish with giving some solutions because we got this kind of hint that it would be good to talk not only about problems, but also about what we can do about it in this talk. So that's what I will focus on. Now, when it comes to the first aspect is that perhaps it comes as no surprise to many of you, but it's good to reiterate it, that the kind of connectivity, infrastructure and access, the skills that people have and the availability of relevant content that we need to be able to participate in politics in these digital societies and engage civically online are unequally distributed, and that unequal distribution follows historical inequalities of unequal participation. And then I'm talking about who determines the global discourse around what are kind of ideas and ideologies that are valued and prominent in terms of global south, global north, in terms of, authoritarian or democratic regimes and capitalist systems versus other kinds of systems and how they are unequally distributed. And we can see that, regions and locations that have been historically disenfranchised are also disenfranchised in terms of these basic ingredients to be able to actually participate in this increasingly digital world. In addition to that, we can see that the belief in the ability of the internet and technologies, information and communication technologies, to improve political participation, so to empower people who might not have had power historically, is also unequally distributed. And it disadvantages particularly the disconnected, and thus the disenfranchised, in autocratic regions in particular. So the people who already have historically had the least voice on a global stage, but also in a local stage, tend to have lower confidence in the ability of technologies to allow them to participate and have their voices heard, and therefore are less likely to be able to or wanting to also participate in these debates. So I'll illustrate that with two slides. We do research around the world with this project. It's called From Digital Skills to Tangible Outcomes. And this, for those of you who know Brazil, you might know Sao Paulo. And what we see here is that, for example, in terms of access, which is having access to broadband, in terms of the number of people that actually use the internet, but also in terms of the number of individuals that actually participate most actively online, that we can see that these maps of digital inequalities in terms of access kind of and use and the kind of the breadth of use or the skills that people have are map on quite clearly onto where historically the elites have been, where economic power has been generated within this city. And, you know, these are patterns that we see within within cities that are heavily unequal, but also within countries in terms of regions within countries and globally. So it's kind of, if you don't have access and you don't have the skills or the content that's online is generated by certain individuals who are not like you, then you can imagine that certain types of people are being left out of that space to even have their voices heard. And then the second point that I mentioned earlier was about these regional differences in belief, about the safety of, or the kind of efficacy of being able to participate online. And what we see here on the left is a kind of offline belief that, you know, like you can safely participate and have your voice heard offline, which is a kind of, if we look at the kind of political regimes in these countries and whether they're autocratic or more democratic, is slightly randomly distributed in the sense that that has more to do with what people consider as valued participation offline. When we look at the online space, we see very clearly, especially people who use the technology, tend to believe that, you know, it's safe to participate and to online, kind of overlaps with more autocratic regimes. So kind of that gives us a sense of optimism, right? So in countries with, to a certain extent, less political freedom, it seems encouraging in first instance that these internet users believe more strongly in the power of these communication technologies to influence those in power and to be able to have your voice heard. However, we also see that as we go along that line of kind of more democratic and more autocratic or less political freedom regimes, that the people who are not online have much less belief in, you know, the ability to participate in political debates and have their voices heard. And like from what our research shows when we go into that, and that kind of takes me also to the last section of my presentation, is that they feel that or the people who are not online tend to be less part of the kind of elite that feels comfortable that they won't be persecuted and won't be their voices and opinions won't put them in danger. So that's what we get then online is a world in which the most frequently accessed content in terms of the people who are participating in debate that is produced online comes from people who come from these historically kind of more empowered regions and from within these regions the people who are kind of as a group have been historically more empowered. So what we see globally on the internet is that the majority of the frequently accessed content produced online comes indeed from the global north, even when it regards the global south. And a big example of this is Wikipedia, where we see that the majority of the articles, for example, produced about, let's say, the African continent, originates in countries like the US and Europe. And the majority of the content produced in public online spaces comes from neighborhoods and regions where privileged and well-connected people live and work. So if we look at the content on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, images that we see online of neighborhoods, of how people live their lives, of what is normal, they tend to come from these kind of neighborhoods, which leads to kind of feeling of the same platforms and the same kind of engaging in the same spaces online is very unequal, depending on the background of the person, but also the location of the person that is engaging with that content. They might feel underrepresented, they don't see their views heard. Now, in the research, and I discuss this in the book, is that one of the things, the processes that lead to, is that this creation of homogenous public spaces where people, you know, who have held and regions that have held historically privileged positions can have to discuss a wide variety of topics, have a wide variety of their views kind of heard by others, while people who don't feel safe or who, when they are in those spaces, feel that their views are diminished or, you know, even they might be harassed because of these, they tend to kind of separate themselves into safe private spaces. So it's not that these individuals don't have or these areas, global areas, regions in the world don't have spaces where they can talk about it, but it's mostly people like them, like these safe private spaces. What you get then is that these participants from these less privileged groups or regions, well, they will hear their own experiences represented, but they are still exposed to these homogeneously, normatively dominant content that is available in these public spaces. While the people who are in these public spaces, the more elite kind of audience of these public spaces will not be confronted with other views. And so what I say here in that last point is that polarization, it's not so much polarization within these public spaces, although that's what the media gives most attention to, is more seen as alienation, a lack of voice of historically disenfranchised, saying, you know, people not feeling heard anymore in this increasingly digital world. I'll move on to my last slide in terms of them. Kind of solutions. So one of these things, and this is it's really kind of great to hear the previous presenters, and especially some of the research that Maria was doing really reflects that what we hear, and that is kind of my second point, is that actually how people experience these online debates and these how they participate depends a lot on the areas and the spaces that we live our everyday lives in. These can be neighborhoods, but these are schools, companies we work for, the kind of everyday spaces that we move in. And one of the things in terms of the solutions, therefore, is to really kind of interventions or changing people's kind of advocacy or idea of what is valid participation and what are valid views takes place not at the national level, not in big public awareness campaigns. It doesn't take place at the individual level in teaching individuals how they should participate online, but it's really in this kind of networked or physical space that we live in that these changes need to take place. And I'll just close with this last point, which is actually the first point on the slide, is that kind of individual civic literacy training in terms of saying like, this is how you participate in debate online, or this is your technical skills to be able to access these platforms, doesn't really work to bring people together, because mere exposure to others' opinions is not going to do it. Actually, what we see in terms of interventions that work is collective awareness creation about how our way of participating and our way of presenting our lives in these digital spaces kind of almost implicitly excludes others who feel unheard, or you know, when we don't react to their comments, when they don't see themselves represented in the mass of content that the elites reproduce. And that does for interventions need to be especially amongst the privileged, who might not actually even be aware that their behaviors in these online spaces are excluding others, who then become disenfranchised and might close themselves off in these separate spaces until it explodes and it comes into the real world, as we might have seen to a certain extent in what happened in the US in the recent elections with you know, the storming of the Capitol, as it's been called by some. So I'll leave it here, and I'll hand over to Neil to introduce the next speaker.
Wonderful, thank you. That's, I mean, like, really interesting stuff, and I think also probably should make everyone reflect on their own social media use sometimes as well. But I think that was wonderful stuff. So we're going to hand over now to Andres, and also wonderful, Ellen, that I didn't need to remind you on the timing as well. So thank you very much for that. And now, Andres, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Neil, and thank you very much to the Inequalities Institute for having me here. I, like the others, I'm going to share my slides. Hopefully you can see them on the presentation. And I'm going to start by saying that, well, there has been a challenge to the system. The Western world gave itself a system. That system has come under increasing strain. There are two types of challenges, one coming from parties that are either new or were marginal until relatively recently, and over the last decade, or perhaps a bit longer in some cases, have become now parties that attract a considerable share of the vote in many of the countries. We can go to the Front National, for example, or for example, in Italy, the Lega or the Movimento Cinque Stelle. So parties that have led to the collapse of the party systems as we knew them for quite some time in places like France or Italy, you have similar parties right and left, like Alternative für Deutschland or the Swedish Democrats or Syriza, springing out elsewhere. And this has also led to a radicalization of mainstream parties that have moved to the right and to the left, to the extent that we can today consider the Conservative Party as almost an anti-system party, which is the ultimate irony, I would say, and also the Republican Party. But it's also that the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn was not too far away from that sort of anti-system situation in but to the left. And every single election, we are just now scrutinizing what is the share of this, of the vote of this for these parties. Because parties that were very marginal have become now either serious threats. So we can talk about the case of France, where Marine Le Pen is a serious prospect to become president of France, something that her father never achieved to do. But in many parts of Europe, Poland, Hungary, in the past in Greece, has been the case with Cinque Stelle and Lega in Italy, or it has been the case in the UK with Boris Johnson. These anti-system sort of, if you want to put it, illiberal or populist type of parties, left and right, have taken power. Of course, the biggest impact has been the election of Donald Trump in the US, as president of the US in 2016. And why has this happened? And of course, here there has been a myriad of work, and I think Maria, Ellen and Jonathan have pointed into many of the causes. Many of the causes have been people looking, mostly coming from political science, at individual characteristics. Not going to go in detail into them, but I think Jonathan summarized them very well as the sort of Ford and Goodwin type of approach that is old, white, uneducated men with limited opportunities stuck in the places of their place of origin that are the ones that are driving this change. So it's age, it's education, is something that Neil once has highlighted in the past, which is being anchored, being immobile, being anchored to the place where you have lived, not being able to move, as Jonathan was highlighting before. But also people that are poor, penniless, and have limited opportunities. But together with the individual sort of characteristics, there's one that seems to be becoming far more important in more recent accounts of the rise of anti-system voting, of illiberal voting, of populist voting, and that is inequality. And here we have two types of inequality. One that has been mainly highlighted by Jonathan here, but comes from a big tradition in economics, also political science, but Daniel Roderick has been putting a lot of emphasis in this type of analysis, which is the idea of the rise of inequalities between people. And here you have the maps. They vary from one place to the other in the case of the US and Europe, but mostly inequalities and strong interpersonal inequalities affect either big cities, or they affect relatively poor places rather than, let's say, more equal places. Of course, there's also a division in the case of Europe according to welfare regimes that were mentioned by Jonathan, with lower inequality in the Nordic countries, much higher inequality in Britain, for example, or the Anglo-Saxon system, or in the Mediterranean countries. In contrast to interpersonal inequality and the rise of interpersonal inequality, what we have is also interterritorial inequality, which in most cases has been rising. And I mean, Phil McCann has been highlighting this for the case of the UK, where the rise has been spectacular, but the UK is not the exception, it's the rule. I like to put this map that you see here on the left, which is a map of Europe, a very simple map of Europe, which is the transformation in terms of economic performance, in terms of GDP per capita of regions in Europe, dividing between dark green, which are the overperforming regions, those regions that in the last quarter of the century have grown above the national average, and light green, which are those regions that have grown below the national average. And you can take a look at France. There, France, 22 regions before the 2016 reform, only one region has grown above the national average. So what we have seen is the region of Paris, we have seen massive concentration of economic activity in the most dynamic, the biggest city, the capital region. And France is the same as the UK, is the same as what we see in Portugal, in most of Central and Eastern Europe, what we see in Belgium, or what we see in the Nordic countries. The other model is highlighted there is the case of Italy, in which in a country that hasn't grown that much over the last quarter of a century, the regions that have performed better were already the rich regions, the poor regions have been left behind. And that's the situation we find in Spain, we find, for example, in Austria, in the Netherlands, or in Germany and Poland. In the case of the US, it's also similar. Concentration of more dynamic, like this is employment generation, along the West Coast, along the East Coast, and you have a big dorsal, a big sort of line between North Dakota and the Mexican border in Texas, where economic activity has grown relatively little. There has been less employment generation, as has been the case in many parts of the South, like most of Kentucky, or many parts of rural Georgia, Mississippi, or Alabama. And when we put all this together, we have to bear in mind that interpersonal inequalities tend to be far larger than interterritorial inequalities. If we have done this analysis, I've done it with Vasilis Selios for the case of Europe, and we find that interpersonal inequalities within a territory, within a district, within a city or a region, represent 70% of all inequalities in Europe. 50% of the rest of inequalities tend to be inter-regional inequalities within countries, and the rest, the remaining 15%, is inequalities across countries. So interpersonal inequalities tend to be far larger than interterritorial inequalities. The final type of inequality that I'm not going to dwell too much on is the urban-rural type of inequality. So what determines this rise of discontent, this rise of resentment that is at the heart of the vote for anti-system populist parties? And here, what we find, I'm not looking at the cultural dimension that has been stressed by Maria in greater detail, I'm mainly focusing on the economic dimension. And what we find in the case of Europe is that mainly of the factors that were highlighted before is one factor, and this is a strong coincidence with Maria, is fundamentally levels of education. People with low levels of formal education actually are linked to higher vote for liberal parties. It's not all people. What we find is that all people tend to be stuck in places that have been declining and have been declining for a very long time. And in Europe, what we find is that very strong economic decline over the last quarter of a century and industrial decline are strong factors at the root of anti-system vote. By contrast, interpersonal inequality is not. Places with stronger interpersonal inequality actually tend to vote far less than places that are far more equal for anti-system and liberal parties. In the case of the US, what we find, if I can move my slide down, is that the additional support for Donald Trump was very much connected to economic decline. And I'm going to highlight the type of economic decline, especially in places with relatively strong social capital. Similar to Europe, interpersonal inequality is strongly connected, in this case, to a lower vote, additional vote for Donald Trump. In the case of the US, more individual factors like race, education, levels of employment matter more, and they matter more than they do in the case of Europe. But in terms of inequality, we have different types of decline. In Europe, what we find...
We've got a minute left. And it's...
Yes, I'm wrapping up at the moment.
So thank you. You're talking about our joint work, so I don't want to stop you.
In Europe, what we find is that it's mainly economic and industrial decline, that declines in employment or relative declines in employment and population do not matter that much for anti-system voting. In the case of the US, it's not declines or relative declines in wages or in earnings, it's much more relative declines in overall employment in the community and in population than seem to be the drivers. So on the whole, What I'm going to try to say is here that in the end, it's not that interpersonal inequality is unimportant for anti-system voting. What we do find is that interpersonal inequality has been growing and has been growing fast, but at the moment it's not igniting, it's not challenging the system. It might do in the future, and we need to pay attention to it. But a type of, which is not really inequality, because in the end, it's many areas that were doing relatively well some time ago that are now declining, that are the ones that are brewing this resentment, this discontent against the system. And these are the ones that are challenging the system. And this is important because in the end, it's a process that has been brewing for some time. Maria, Jonathan have been talking about austerity and the crisis and the reaction to the crisis. And that has been important in the way we have reacted. But the problem is, and the important problem has been that this has not happened over the last 10 years. The crisis might have been diffused, but in the case of the US, we trace this back to the 1970s. Places that have been declining since the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s are the ones that are driving this change. And this is something that we need to pay attention, because if we forget about these places, and we can have a discussion with Jonathan about mobility and the capacity of people to move later on, we forget about these places, many of the challenges, many of the changes that are being proposed that would make our society far better are not going to be implemented, because if we want a green revolution, if we want more equality, it's going to be prevented by parties that may, in certain ways, be more or less right in the diagnosis behind the discontent. But the proposals or the solutions that are being proposed are far worse than anything that we have at the moment. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andreas. Thank you. So we're going to kick off with a round of questions, and I'll go through the, I'll let all the panelists have a go, but I'll take three questions at a time. So the first one is directed at Maria, but I think other people have can have a go at it as well, which is from Maria Savona at the University of Sussex, who focuses on the idea that manual workers in higher educated areas would be more likely to vote Remain as compared to those in lower educated areas. And she wants to sort of comment on that from Maria, and the others might want to sort of talk about it a bit more. There's a question which I think is sort of really good for Ellen, so I'd focus this on Ellen, which is from Lee Wan, about since the algorithms of social media platforms favour the most radical or the fake news, how can we incentivize users to endorse the logic of a collective user responsibility, which I think is a great and probably quite a big question. And then final one for the sort of first round is from Nick Clifton at Cardiff Met, who talks about sorting and migration. So exactly what you were talking about a moment ago, Andreas. So what is the role of sorting in these processes, particularly of younger and more educated people leave and don't come back? And then he also asks this other question, which is what can we do about it to make areas of relative decline more attractive, to return people back in? So if I can go with Maria first, we'll go in the order we took people presented in, please.
Yes. So thanks, Maria. I'm going to answer your question. So the question is, why do people vote similarly to their neighbours, or why do they follow the cultural context when they're voting? And there's quite a big literature on this, but it's a mixture of social emulation and sort of meeting your neighbours in different spaces, offline and online, and therefore reaching a consensus on what's happening locally and therefore voting a certain way. But it could also be local parties mobilising. So you move into an area where, say, UKIP or the Brexit Party was well organised, you're much more likely to come across the political programme, and that might increase their vote. I'll just briefly say something on the other question about sorting and whether we can attract higher education students back to these areas. I think it's very difficult to attract graduates back to where they started. And as in the Norris and Inglehart book, Cultural Backlash book, they talk about resentment in these declining areas when the graduates come back and the older generations find them changed. And this causes resentment of higher education. So I think it's easier to keep them in the area in the first place by maybe expanding the new universities and the local colleges that serve the kinds of employment that the local area needs. that would be my policy suggestion.
Wonderful, thank you. We'll go on to Jonathan next, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this this question is really not really directed at my presentation, I don't think, but what I can do is answer a little bit about my own experience, which is I grew up in the, it's not a left behind place, but it's a left behind region, Yorkshire and Humberside, and ended up leaving. And part of the reason I left was because it was exactly not the kind of place where you would find graduate employment. I grew up near Hull in a small town called Beverley, which some of you may have heard of, even though it's quite small. It was famously announced by The Guardian to be the cheapest place in Britain to have a middle-class lifestyle about a decade ago. And for precisely that reason, it's now become a magnet for people who don't necessarily work there, but want to live there. It's near the M62. It's very connected to not only Hull, but also York and Leeds, or Sheffield. You can get to all of these places within an hour. And it's now suddenly become a place that has attracted lots of people doing professional jobs, and has led to some tensions my family complained about. Now it's, you can't move around, you can't drive anywhere, there's too much traffic. Meanwhile, Hull, which is only a 10-minute train ride away, is still extremely depressed and heading towards, you know, possibly even returning Tory MPs and then you guys as defenders of the working class. So I just thought I'd throw that anecdote in there in the over more academic response.
Wonderful, thank you. Ellen, you might want to pick up specifically on my, and also Jonathan, I'm going to ask you questions about anything. So sorry, apologies in advance even. Ellen, if you could take specifically the question about sort of, you know, how we get people to ignore fake news, but then any comments on the other stuff is great as well.
No, I think actually I will introduce my answer to that question by reacting to the first question, because this is something that we see quite often, or the recent research in this kind of area where more social digital ecology approaches have been taken, which is really about situating people's online kind of engagement and behaviors within the offline physical context in which we live and move. And what we see there, for example, is that somebody, education is a big predictor of whether you will participate actively in digital spaces, having your voice heard. So that's another kind of point of overlap with what Maria and others were talking about. But what we see is that people with kind of who are from disenfranchised groups, who've normally not been heard, who live in areas where they see a lot of other people participate, or where there's a lot of diversity and not homogeneity, but heterogeneity in terms of political participation offline, where they've had that experience, where they also feel supported in when they give a contrary experience or opinion, that there will be people who support them, that we see that these are people, even though they come from groups where we kind of would expect them not to engage as actively, if they live in areas and they move in areas where they see other people engage and where they've had a kind of training of being in that kind of resistance or kind of in that position, that they are also much more likely to engage online, even if they come from more impoverished backgrounds or, you know, discriminated backgrounds. So we see that same pattern happening. And that's because there is, you know, if you live in a very homogenous environment where you see everybody, let's say everybody's disenfranchised, they have given up on the system, they are given up on being able to participate digitally because they don't have the skills or because, you know, the spaces they encounter are not for them or reflect their experiences, they tend to retract, both first of all to offline spaces and talk to people like them. So that's kind of, I think, a pattern that kind of introduces my answer to the other, to kind of the solution that you were hinting at. I think, first of all, we need to understand that algorithms are not some kind of magic thing that has come falling from the sky. Algorithms do what drives most traffic. And the people who drive most traffic are the people who use sites. So that's where this collective responsibility, kind of an awareness that every click we make and every kind of, you know, thing we like or we buy or, you know, that this will influence what the future internet will look like, because, or the future digital space will look like, because it learns from our behaviors. And so, and people often think of this digital as something separate, right? It's like, okay, there's the social media thing, the social media space. And it's not disconnected, first of all, from all the other behaviors that we have online, because algorithms on social media sites look at all the behavior that we do across platforms, at what we buy, at what we like, at what we appreciate. So even if we are kind of passively just consuming information, this is what will be pushed to the front. So in reaction to your comment on how can we use this idea, is that first of all, there's collective action to be taken by saying, is this the future that we want for these kinds of radical ideas or fake kind of news to be pushed? Because in the end, they're being pushed because that's what we look at and that's what we like. And we can say that we don't want to be fed that kind of stuff. And you know, that's where collective action in terms of human rights activity, organizations, people have been pushing against kind of this ideology to be there. However, it has to be said that that isn't, you know, what is going on in that digital space is not disconnected from what is going on. And, you know, all my fellow colleagues here have been describing these processes of populism and radicalization and a kind of disenfranchisement offline. And as long as you have a political system or people who are very active in these spaces, who have a sense of power because they are empowered in general societies in which they live to spread those ideas and to engage in that way with other groups or to ignore certain voices. Then if you don't deal with that in the offline space, it's not gonna happen either in the online space. Yeah, so there's a collective awareness that, you know, in some ways it's a mirror that's being hauled up to ourselves when we say like, why am I seeing all this fake news? Why am I seeing all this? And it's not something an individual user can do as much, but this is where we have organizations that have worked for a very long time to promote, you know, diversity in the press, the protection of human rights, and you know, the giving of a platform to people who might not have a voice. And it's those organizations that have a long history that can influence the offline, because in the end, it's physical companies that make these algorithms. It's programmers, it's people who are trying to, you know, feed the beast with our behaviors that are creating these algorithms, and they can change what is a good outcome of the algorithms. And if we collectively say, this is not the world we want to live in, then there can be action can be taken, but that has to be done by collectives. That can be done by individuals, because an individual changing their behavior is not going to be, it's going to be a drop in the sea. And this is really algorithms based on big data, not on small data in a sense. So that's where I think the collective responsibility comes in.
Wonderful, thank you. If we move on to Andreas. Now.
Yeah, thank you very much, Neil. I'm going to just briefly go touch on two questions. The one from Maria on the whole idea of why people vote similarly. And here, nice to hear from you, Maria. Here, I'm going to link this to Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone. He said that in 2000, when he published his book, that American democracy was at risk because of the decline of social capital. What we're finding in work I'm doing with Neil and some colleagues is that, in fact, the type of social capital, which might be different from what others understand as social capital, is actually driving this reaction against the system. Places that have been declining for a very, very long time, but have got strong, very strong levels of associationism are the ones that have turned in droves to support Donald Trump. So there might be some collective sort of reaction there that would require much more, let's say, sociological or anthropological type of studies to understand it in far greater detail as the ones, for example, Kathy Kramer conducted in Wisconsin. The question by Nick, and thanks very much for your question on sorting, I think this is absolutely crucial. And here I'm going to talk about mobility. The people, there's a massive sorting process. So the youngest, the most talented, the most educated are moving into cities. The rest, for many reasons, are staying behind. And that is creating all sorts of problems and all sorts of undesirable problems. The people that stay behind is not because they don't want to get on their bike. There would be some that would, yes, say, I have my life, I'm very happy being from Boston, Lincolnshire, the place that voted with the highest percentage for Brexit. I got my life here, I got my social capital, my family, my friends, and I want to stay here. But even if you offer them housing in London, what is a high school dropout from Boston, Lincolnshire, or from central Missouri, or from, let's say, Görlitz in East Germany going to do in terms of work in London or in San Francisco or in Frankfurt or Munich? probably the chances that this person is going to be competitive is going to be rather, are going to be rather limited. And that is going to create problems, because if you are an East German, let's say a man of 25, and you see that your best qualified mates, mostly women because they do better at school, have left, and you're left there with less possibilities of finding a partner, with an aging population surrounding you, then you're in trouble. And then you're going to be angry and you're going to be unhappy. And this is what's happening, because many of these places are not providing the right sort of opportunities for people to stay there or to attract other people. And of course, we're always focusing on this idea that the reality is what we see in the US or what we see in Britain. But there are other realities that are working and working in different ways. And that's the case of Germany. Not East Germany, but West Germany, Switzerland, parts of the Nordics, for example, Denmark, in which what you have is that many small towns, rural areas, medium-sized cities, places like Ingolstadt, places like Karlsruhe, places like Freiburg, in the south of Germany, have hidden champions. They have big firms that are world leaders, that are dynamic, and that are attracting a significant, highly qualified people to work in their firms and in their places. So the situation we see in the UK is not the only reality. Why has Germany succeeded at that and the UK has not? Well, we have to ask our politicians and decision makers about that. We have to ask our firms about that. But there's an alternative out there that can be used to make sure that we fight the rise in discontent and rise in polarization that we're seeing, that is creating the seeds for a very, very dangerous society.
Wonderful. So topical to that response is Danny Dickinson's question, which actually focused on Jonathan's presentation, which is about populism. The first thing I say is, you know, you should read Jonathan's book and you'll be calling it anti-system politics rather than populism. He says populism has sort of, you know, nasty economic consequences, can erode trust in institutions and social capital. So does it have a long-term future, or is it simply a sort of, you know, crisis response? He makes the point that it wasn't sustained in Greece, for example, and also the sort of the poor pandemic response of many populist governments. Trenton Marler, another great question. I think this is sort of, you know, something I'd be very, you know, grateful for your opinion on in particular, Andres. Does federalism help alleviate citizens' grievances tied to regional inequalities, and in particular in the UK, is devolution the answer? And then we have a sort of, you know, big question from Flavio Comin from Raymond Lull University in Barcelona and Cambridge, about the literature on the political economy of redistribution that says people's political views are based on their perceptions about the deservingness of the poor and race. What do you think about these factors? Is it about people's sort of perceptions of poverty and race? Because we haven't talked about race very much today. So if we go in the same order, is that okay, Maria? Do you want to go first?
Yeah, so I wanted to say something on the issue of decentralization. And I think this is absolutely the key, at least in the UK context, because we have a very messy system of local and regional governments and basically no accountability. And we seem to be going in the wrong direction in terms of centralization. So I think that some of these issues would be solved, particularly the feeling of control, lack of control and agency, by having a proper system of local government with properly devolved powers and funding. Of course, there are also challenges to do with capabilities and accountability and trying to avoid capture by certain local groups. But I think that at least for the UK, that would be the solution. I don't really have much to say on populism. I'm not an expert on the literature.
That's fine. We'll go to Jonathan. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, one of the risks of writing a book like I just wrote is that as soon as you published it, things can start to change. You can confidently predict. I try to avoid making predictions, but I think I focused on trying to explain why there is this, you know, pattern of people voting for anti-establishment or anti-system parties. But of course, we've had experiences of some of these parties actually taking power, and that raises a whole range of interesting questions. I noticed a question in the Q&A from Nick, who was asking about whether he considered the Conservatives whether we should consider the Conservatives as a populist party. And I think that's a really great question, because if you look at what's happening at the moment in the UK, well, what's really happened is a mainstream, the most establishment of establishment parties possible party has effectively kind of co-opted a set of disgruntled voters through this vehicle of the UK Brexit Party. And the big question now is, what do they do with these voters, right? And this is, in a sense, what we're going to find out over the next two or three years. Are they really serious about levelling up? Or is this just the kind of rhetoric to disguise the fact that what they've really done is, you know, played a little trick on some disgruntled, alienated former Labour voters and promised them all kinds of things, when in the end, they're still going to be end up defending the same old interests that the Tories generally do, which is, you know, the business community, financial interests, and so on. So, I mean, this is what we're going to see, you know, we're going to see an answer to. But in the case of the more sort of left-wing anti-system movements that have reached power, and I think Andreas mentioned Syriza, also we've had, you know, the Five Stars movement, not clearly a left-wing party, but certainly not a right-wing populist one, getting to government in Italy. And what, of course, they end up doing is bumping up against these constraints which created the discontent in the first place, which is there is no money, right? Of course, there is a kind of magic money tree, but the European Central Bank is very careful about how to dispense it. And there is, you know, we still live in a world where, despite all the movements against globalization and all the pushback and some, you know, some mini trade wars and so on, in the end, global capital goes wherever it wants. And this is the problem Syriza faced. You know, do you actually exit the euro and take your chances with all of what that might mean to a society that's already struggling? Or do you accept the constraints imposed on you by Eurozone membership? And this is why I'll come back to Biden, which I think, even though Biden isn't an anti-system politician, this could be, you know, if the US decides to do things like, you know, reviving Keynesian stimulus, like basically cajoling or bullying other countries into raising levels of capital taxation to help finance redistributed programs. If they take seriously, you know, movements to cut off the flow of funds to tax havens and so on, all of this could be really serious stuff, which could open up a world of opportunity for anti-system parties, or at least the ones that really do want to do something to make capitalism work for more people. So the big question is, you know, will any of these anti-system parties still be left standing by that time? And will parties like the Conservative Party, which has kind of profited from the anti-system mood without really being anti-system, will they try to change things, or will they sort of paper over a few cracks and just try and leave things as they are? And I honestly don't know the answer to that question, but maybe that's my next book when it's happened.
Andreas.
Thank you very much. Two questions, I think, for me. One is this going to be sustained? And well, Jonathan asked, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think there's a serious risk that it might be sustained, because the sources of discontent are there, and there would be new sources that would come from probably interpersonal inequality that would add on top of interterritorial inequality. Having said that, we have to be very careful, because we know in Greece, Syriza won and then lost, and now we have, let's say, a more mainstream government. But is this going to be the case everywhere? And here I would put in, I would highlight the strength of democratic institutions. I think that in the UK, with all the problems of Brexit and everything, or in the US, democratic institutions are relatively strong. So if I were to make predictions, probably, perhaps this would disappear, or let's say the democratic institutions would preserve the sort of system that we had before and would be more robust. But have we not turned a corner in Hungary? Have we not turned a corner in Poland? And a corner that where we cannot go back. And of course, we are looking now mainly at Western countries. And this is relatively new. You have to go back to the 1920s and 30s to see something similar. But in the developing world, this is not a new phenomenon. And the Argentinians have been suffering this since the 1930s. And look at where Argentina was in the 1920s and where it is now, both socially and economically and politically. Look at Thailand, that has been undergoing this since the 1990s. The poster child in terms of economic development until then, now one of the worst performing countries in Southeast Asia, and where democracy has gone massively in reverse. Let's look at Russia, for example, to highlight others. Then there's a question of devolution and federalism. Is that a solution? And although I've done quite a lot of work on devolution, I would hesitate that it is a solution in any way for two reasons. First, because we tend to devolve at the wrong points in time. We tend to devolve when there's a massive crisis. And we are now in the process of a crisis. And for example, the British government is trying to look at devolution as a sort of panacea. But of course, devolution is not strongly demanded across all regions in the UK or elsewhere. And very often when you devolve in a crisis, you transfer powers, but not resources. So you are putting ill-prepared governments with no resources in charge to solve what are bigger problems. So in the end, you end up with systems of decentralized systems that very often do not deliver, both in terms of achieving more satisfaction, political satisfaction, and especially in delivering greater economic benefits for the people of their regions. And of course, there would be that you will have stronger regions, basically those with more taxation, more capacity, places like London to actually benefit from their internal capacities, and other regions that would be under-resourced and with lower capacity to actually collect taxes. So we might end up with a recipe that, although on paper might work, in reality is unlikely to deliver the goods of tackling the roots of the problem of lack of development and economic decline in many of these places.
Wonderful. So I'm going to sort of, we don't have long left, so I'm just going to ask you to give a relatively quick answer to one more question, which is sort of posed by Adelaide Haug. And basically, you know, the question here is that, you know, we've seen COVID and we've seen the sort of technology shock of COVID. And many people have said that this is going to mean that, you know, suddenly we can work from anywhere and it's possible for you to sort of, you know, go and, you know, Jonathan, you can go and live in Beverly and sort of, you know, teach at the LSE. And all that sort of stuff is possible again. And I'm, you know, we have a sort of standard answer to this as sort of economic geographers, like sort of Andreas, myself, and Maria is probably similar. So I'm interested in everyone's view on, you know, is this going to come about? Are we going to be sort of not worrying about sort of, you know, regional spatial inequality in the context of digitalization in the aftermath of the COVID shock? So I'll go with Maria again first. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think it's too early to tell. Obviously, my own hunch is we'll see a little bit. So I'll just say from what I've observed. So I live in a small town in the Fens, and I have seen a big increase in activity in the place where I live. And the people who are normally commuting to London or Cambridge and are out of the town are now in the town centre during the day. And it has really changed the nature of the town and the interactions, and it's more lively and there's a lot more going on. And so I think we won't see a massive reconfiguring of the economic geography, but we will see a little bit a spreading of, the location of professionals and therefore of the wealth and the activity that goes with it.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Jonathan, do you have a quick answer?
I think I was born in the wrong place because I find it too cold up there these days. You know, I'm not going to give up the balmy climate of Crouch End, even though it'd be very easy to do so. I mean, as academics, we've been doing the sort of post-COVID remote working thing for quite a while, and many people live far away from where they work. I think on the margin, it has to make a difference, especially for people. I mean, I think I remember reading somewhere that commuting is one of the things that makes people most unhappy, right? The time spent on the train, especially if you have to go in several times a week or every day, is something that most people would do without. And I'm